Hey, this is Mark A. Altman, creator and executive producer of Pandora, and welcome to Unboxing Pandora, a weekly podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the new series that debuts on Tuesday, July 16th on the CW and around the world. Each week, we'll visit with your favorite Pandora cast and crew members and get an insider look at the making of this exciting new sci-fi series. And for more bonus content, don't forget to visit us on Twitter and Instagram at CW Pandora or hashtag PandoraCW and Pandora Writers. Now, let's open the box on Pandora. Hey, this is Mark A. Altman, creator and executive producer of Pandora, and I'm here with executive producer and writer of Masters of War and director of Masters of War, Mr. Christian Gossett.
Hello.
Hey, and this was a great episode that aired tonight. I love it. Steve, can you talk about first of all, you know, where the idea came from for the episode, and you know why you really enjoyed writing it?
Well, obviously, it is influenced by Heart of Darkness, searching for Colonel Kurtz up the river, up the spaceway, about a missing ship and captain, which supposedly got wiped out during the war, but they're still around. A bit of a ghost ship, a mystery. So it's about a great moment in Earth's history that is not exactly what people thought it was. And Jax and her friends meet this war hero, and it's not exactly what they expected.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about that episode that people might not know is the reason you called it the Seahawk.
Right. It has dual meaning now. Thankfully, it fits your noir sense. In vintage movies, Errol Flynn's the Seahawk, and also my favorite NFL football team, and Chris LeDoux's the Seahawks of Seattle.
Yeah, he gave us even better special effects because it was the Seahawk. He had to make the Seahawk a winner. So,
exactly. The Seahawk's a little different than the other battle cruisers, you notice. It's sort of in a little disrepair.
That's my dad's favorite movie as well, the Seahawk.
Really?
Yeah.
So what a dream of a lifetime to direct an episode with the Seahawk.
It was so cool. It was so cool. I connected with the episode in so many ways. It was like you guys had written it for me, frankly. Having read Conrad in high school, I grew up in a library. My house was like a library. So Conrad was like, you know, we talked about that over camping trips, and which is sounds like kind of a strange childhood, but it was.
Yeah, kind of does.
All right, everyone, quote poetry now. I just want a marshmallow.
And now we will read the Canterbury Tales as we like to have our s'mores.
Exactly. It was kind of like that. But yeah, it was, and all the combat, from the fighting to the gunfights to the, you know, to Raylan having to deal with this onslaught of bigotry and come out and not let it overcome him. It's just a blast.
Yeah, no, that's great. And you know who's just amazing in the episode is Ben. You know, Ben who plays Raylan, Ben Radcliffe. I mean, boy, talk about, nailing the ridiculousness of racism. I just think it's so interesting to deal with it through the lens of sort of this xenophobia towards this alien race. It feels very of the moment, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's not easy for him to be on campus, and I think there's moments where he's thought of leaving, but this is when he's there to stay, as he tells everyone in the black hole.
I was so happy when you guys, in the writer's room even, when you were talking about the show, that you guys were going to go ahead and do this stuff that you talked about doing for so long, these kinds of stories, you know, using the metaphor of an alien being attacked by bigots as opposed to the literal sense, which is what great sci-fi does, and we've been talking about it for years, and I was so excited to hear that you guys were going that way with the show.
We got to do something on these internment camps. I feel, you know, we all feel so powerless to do anything about, you know, and I think it would be great to do something to comment on how awful that is. I'm not sure how we would do it, you know, I will say, I remember in the writer's room, it was, I think, John Kelly who wrote or is writing 109, who came up with the idea that there would be some kind of racist name for the Zetarians. And I don't remember who came up with it, but it just seemed to
perfect.
It was great. I mean, a lot of that stuff, the room was so helpful in that respect.
This didn't have a B story at the beginning. It was very strong A story with searching for the Seahawk, but it didn't really have, and it was just Raylan and then dealing with the problems on campus became the B story.
Yeah.
Which is at the end, you know, near the end, it definitely, I was trying to figure out a way to climax it properly, and I think it worked out very well.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you know, I remember when you broke, as they say, you broke the back of the story, and you came with this idea of intercutting the Raylan speech with the destruction of the Seahawk and you know, the loss of, when we get to that, the loss of John Kim.
That was the last thing to write. I couldn't figure out how to do, because I was like, it's going to culminate in him going up in open mic night where he's the last person you expect to see up there.
It's so
what does
powerful.
He say?
Yeah.
So then when it overlapped with what was going on in the Seahawk, it was like, that's how to do it.
That's great. I love intercut.
So that was the final thing that we figured out.
And I think that's why it works so well, too. It's just a really, you know, between the music and, you know, Ben's great performance, and, of course, with Priscilla, you know, who plays Jax, and John, who played Greg, were doing, it's just so terrific. And, of course, you know, having John on the show was a real treat for us. In fact, this was old home day for a bunch of people, Steve, that we've worked with in the past. You know, having, you know, both John, who we worked with in Librarians, and then Johan Erb, who was in Asian X for us.
Right, we always wanted to work with him again, and this role came up, and I think I told Mark, I'm like, what do you think about Johan for this? It's like, definitely.
He was a dream come
and
true.
And Johan and I, we do the Culver Stairs and Santa Monica Stairs together in Los Angeles exercising, and I think one trip up, I was telling him about this role, and he just was getting so excited, and he was just like, it turns out he loves sci-fi. And
he's
sci-fi.
He's so in. We were doing deep cuts on sci-fi at that
yeah,
first meeting.
Like,
we
he's
had.
Very, I was like, wow, he's read a lot of sci-fi novels and stuff like that. It's not just like liking the obvious things, it's like deep stuff. So when he thought to be a part of this and to be this role and to be this an important character in the mythology of the Pandora show, he was so into it.
Well, remember, I mean, it was so great when we had him for Agent X. We were casting this role of this larger than life impresario, like a Bond villain who had a private island named Dante, and we just were seeing people who were playing it too small, and just we were so frustrated. It was us and John Terleski, who was directing the episode, and we're sitting in the room, and this guy walks in, and he's larger than life, you know, and somebody once said he's like a Greek god who came down to earth, and he goes, "Why so glum, guys? I'm the answer to all your problems." Now, normally an actor says that, and you're like, "Oh my god, the hell with this guy, this pompous ass." But like, he pulled it off. Like, we were charmed, and we suddenly perked up, and then he gave this amazing audition, and of course he was great in that episode. And, you know, had that show come back for another season, we wanted to bring him back, so we got to bring him back just as a completely different character.
And his energy here, like, just throughout the crew and the cast, like, just loved having this guy around. And
isn't that what they call him?
The Estonian Stallion.
He genuinely does like everybody having a good time. He really wants to just be the sunshine and just make everybody have a blast. It's so fun. He's just a walking party.
He says it's a blessed experience to be on the show and just be doing what the job he does and the jobs that we all do. It's just like, we love doing it.
And so. Rachel was so great. She was so great. She was
amazing. Rachel, who played Pring, who was his captured Zetarian concubine. It's his wife in real life.
Yeah.
And she's a very successful model and actor. And so having her play that role was great. I mean, we lost a little of that in the cut. And, you know, one other thing we really lost was, you know, also the fact that there was a runner with his roommate who had moved out, and there was like this graffiti, and there was a whole scene.
Well, there's a scene where you find out where part of Raylan's journey is you learn that his roommate moved out very quickly when Raylan came to campus, didn't want to live with him. And we could talk about what happened there, you know, that the script was taken very literally in terms of the a vacancy on the other side of the room, and they literally ripped the bed and the shelving unit out of the actual set. So when we got to the set, those pieces of furniture
there.
Were gone, which were bolted into the wall, and there was nothing. It was just a wall on that side of the room. It didn't really play as an empty bed.
No, and then of course, you know, it's too bad because we lost all the stuff about them going on a date in the VR simulator where they were going to do Joan of Arc, and there was some fun stuff there, but you know,
not everything could fit.
Not everything could fit, no. So, but I know it's always interesting to hear about the deleted scenes and things. And there was, you know, a little more Johan also.
I think one of the first things that came up was the photo booth. I thought it'd be funny to have a vintage photo booth, you know, in the bar. And originally, the Cade Collins guy was supposed to throw a guard into the photo booth.
And
it was supposed to get destroyed, so you never see the photo booth again. So if you're actually wondering why the photo booth isn't in there again, it was supposed to get destroyed. But since it was a rented thing, we couldn't destroy it.
I mean, it's funny you say that, because I remember they came to me and said, oh, I do not think we can do this. We cannot rent the photo booth for the whole season. I was like, what are you talking about the whole season? We just need it for one episode. And they're like, but how can it be there and then gone in the next episode? I said, welcome to television, you know.
And American bars as well. I mean, our tradition of collegiate bars is something's there, it's fun, it's a novelty, and then when people stop putting money into it, it's gone.
It's gone, exactly. I loved that whole thing that you came up with, and I think it plays so well in the episode. It's just super fun.
The photo booth, John Kim and Priscilla get the photos together. She keeps the photos, and that was always going to be the button of the episode, was she's going to have that photo of him after what happened. That was always in there. And then we have a conversation between the glass wall.
Yeah.
It was all, everything stayed, all stayed the same. That was some of the original stuff. Before there was any story, I wanted those moments, which Chris magically captured on camera. And I think it's emotional.
Thanks, man. It was really great to put them running through those corridors and trying to get, trying to escape a ship before it self-destructs. It's just like, every science fiction director wants to have that moment, or it's like several of them, and so to have one was a blast.
Yeah. So I hope no one's upset with us, but I think it's a big surprise ending. I mean, I don't know if people expected it.
Well, we always knew we wanted to kill John.
I should say John.
We always knew we wanted to kill Greg. You know, we wanted to kill a major character early on, so you know that anyone could die. And of course, you know, we loved John, and we knew he had a limited availability in his schedule. So it was kind of like, oh my God, maybe John will be interested. And we took John out for Mexican, and we said, we have a great death scene. We don't know anything else beyond that, but we know we're going to kill you. We don't know what you're going to do before that. But, would you be interested in coming to Sophia and doing a couple episodes, and then we'll kill you off? And he was like, I'll do anything for you, which was very flattering when he said that to us. But
then we said it's in Bulgaria, and he said, I'll still do anything for you. That's how real of a friend this guy is.
And I think he was surprised, about what a good time he had. The crew really bonded. It was very the cast, and it was really hard for him to leave because he'd become very good friends with the rest of the cast, and he wanted to stay, and he was like, is there any way we could not kill me? And it's like, no, you're dying. You're done. So, and it's such a beautiful scene. Some people told me, it seems like it was very influenced by Star Trek II. And I'm like, no, it's the one thing that isn't a reference. You just want them physically separated by a barrier.
I think just the glass part made me think of it. But, it's not. And I love the scheduling. That was actually filmed last.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
scene was in the schedule, last thing filmed. Everything led up to it that day. And it was emotional for everyone. Everyone knew it was coming.
Yeah. It was. I remember that day. I was like, "We gotta get to that death scene." I was very driven to like make sure and get everything done to make sure that we had time to hit that right.
No, it's great. And of course, there are all these amazing special effects from Chris Ledoux and his crafty apes, who do all these incredible stuff. I mean, it's a great episode for Xander, and it was the first episode where we had the extra set on board the Earhart because we'd built the cockpit on the Earhart, and then we quickly realized we needed more rooms on the Earhart. So that was the first time we unveiled that new set, which you shot really well. It's really cool. And I just love the scene on at the Riodine factory where, there's this big sort of shootout. And it was funny because I always call that our Miami Vice scene. It's like, you just got to think of it like there's this big drug deal going down, and Sonny and Tubbs are sort of sneaking up on the drug dealers, and then suddenly they get spotted. And, I said, if you just look at that, then it's going to be very easy to track everything. And I think one of the actors was asking, I said, yeah, it's like Miami Vice. And I'm like, what's that? Like, oh my God, they're so young. So young.
Yeah.
I said, we're going to score it with Jan Hammer. That was a deep cut. And so James Olmos is going to show up.
That was a blast. Gunfight. Gunfight in the factory was a blast.
But that was a big day because we started at the university.
That was a super day.
And then we drove, which is like 45 minutes away, and drove to the ride on
Sophia University,
to close the night. It was a full day.
It came out great. And of course, that was the first episode where we had the great Ben Cross, Oscar Award nominee for Chariots of Fire, playing Harlan, who would become an important part of our series mythology. And he's great. The coordinates. And it's just that. I love that. He's a great big bad for the season.
Yeah, it was great directing him inside the suite, the actual historic suite of the Tsar of Bulgaria. Was very cool. That was my office for the day. It was really cool to have
You were directing all that stuff.
I'm taking this room over. I had my stuff on the desk, and I was like, it was very cool.
Yeah.
And you want a big character like Ben Cross in that kind of a room.
Oh, you can only pull it off with somebody like him who's larger than life.
Yeah.
He gives it all. Like he had said, like, I don't know what I'm saying. because I don't think he had the whole script.
For Rao 5.
I don't think he didn't have the whole script.
That's
like,
spoiler.
I don't know what I'm saying. But I was like, everything is very big mythology. It's like, this is a big moment for the show.
Yeah, it's arch.
Yeah, no, it was.
You know what's funny? He doesn't know about his cheekbones. Now, Ben Cross has, like, there are no cheekbones in all of, like, the history of cinema, like Ben Cross's cheekbones. Mm. And I mentioned, and being a visual artist, I couldn't help but mention them. And he didn't know. He didn't know he had these epic cheekbones. I'm like,
how did he react to that?
He was like, it's kind of like, what? I was like, dude, your cheekbones. It's funny. People don't know that actors have, that's kind of the superpower that they have. It's almost the defense mechanism is they don't think about themselves. They can't. They can't be self-conscious. So sorry, Ben. I'll never mention your cheekbones again, I promise.
But we're going to see him tomorrow, so maybe we'll bring it up.
I'm definitely not mentioning his cheekbones ever again.
What was the biggest surprise for you about directing Chris? Like, what took you by surprise?
What took me by surprise, man?
Or what was the most gratifying part of
it? Well, it's all gratifying. Being able to, you know, I come from graphic novels, I come from theater, and I come from collaborative team sport type storytelling. But this was a whole new level. Network episode is just a gigantic, colossal electric train set of fun. I get to talk to all these specialists who are better at what they do than I am. I get to talk to people who can make costumes. I get to talk to people who can be completely vulnerable on camera. I get to talk to people who can make props and build sets and light the thing and shoot the thing and kind of inspire them. I draw everything and hand it out to them, and it's so fun to watch the light bulbs go on in their head, and then they go out and do something and they come back with it. Yasin made these wonderful insignia for the Seahawk dress uniform.
So great.
That was so great. All cast in metal. It was so cool. And I remember, you know, it's great. It's fun to challenge them too. So that was really, I'll tell you what the surprise was, how far I could push, how much I could say to ask for this, make this big ask of some department and have that department come back with something awesome. That was very, like, dangerous, basically. Because next episode would be like, okay, so I need this tractor trailer. And no, don't worry. But it was just so much fun. I'm so glad to be back for another episode. And
so are we. So are we. And then, Steve, I mean, what was the most gratifying part of the episode for you?
Just everyone's reaction to it, because, you know, when you work in a vacuum with the script and an idea, and to see, I wasn't here for the prep of it, but on the first day of filming, and everyone's just so excited about it. So many things that I saw on the page were just like, they were happening, and people seemed excited about it. And luckily, Chris was directing it. Luckily, the cast was all into it. Luckily, the guest stars were all excellent. So just like a germ of an idea turning into something that, you know, 100 different people are working on is just, nothing beats it. As many as you will write and get produced, it's like, it's neat to see it all happen and have it turn out well.
In fact, you know what was the biggest surprise was how well you guys cast the show. That was the biggest surprise for me. Walking in, you know, as a guest director, you're just kind of like paratrooping in and you're hoping that everybody vibes with you. And wow, I couldn't believe how just into it. The cast just leans into it. They have a challenge. You let them know what the challenge is and they just attack the hill. And it is every single moment that we ask them to take on, they just take it on. And so that was real. You guys have been doing this a long time, so it was really nice to see your experience and everything you've been through, I think, culminate in this cast. So it's been a blast working with them.
I think, you know, having people like Johan and John Kim around the regular cast, man, is like, everyone just like, it brings up everyone to a different level. They like working with those type of actors who've been in a lot of other things and bring a lot of experience to the show.
Noah's so great. They're all just, it's just such a pleasure working with them.
To me, like, and it was casted so, it was very quick. I mean,
was
the guest cast in number 103 was like cast like a day later than the regular cast.
Amazing.
It seems almost. So.
Yeah, I mean, it was really sprung on us before you knew it. You know, we had at least a little extra prep, but then still it was still 7 days of just running and gunning.
How has this been for you so far?
Like the show?
Yeah, I mean, I know.
But you saw here. What was it like when there's like the sets are being built and like what's it like seeing it all? So many things.
Yeah, and someone who's wanted a show like this his entire life.
Well, I mean, it was to Steve's question. It was extraordinary. You know, because I came out here to scout and, you know, saw the empty studios, you know, literally, you know, empty, nothing in there. And then, you know, we started scouting around Sophia for locations that could be planets, that could be, you know, different different places throughout the season. And, you know, very early on, we settled on these interiors, you know, what would be the, yeah. No, and you know, we settled in. So you know, to watch the sets going up was really an extraordinary feeling, because every day, you know, we just, you know, you leave and the construction crews would come in, and next morning you wake in, it would be a little more and a little more and a little more, and it was sort of like a time lapse almost. So you know, by the time we're ready to start, we were still building some of the sets when we started to shoot. We started to shoot on location first because the sets weren't finished. So even then, it was like an ongoing process. Yeah. But it was great. I mean, I've told the story before, but I mean, there was one day we were shooting on the back lot, and I think it was for 102, where we were shooting the Seeker, Chimes of Freedom, the compound. And I had to go to my office, and I'm walking through the set at like 3 in the morning. I'm the only one there. Everybody's shooting in the back, and it's quiet, and it's still, but the lights are on. And I'm just standing there alone looking at these sets, and I'm like, wow. I mean, you know, if I could tell the 8-year-old me, you know, it was pretty awesome, because you had the Starfighter, and you had, you know, the Earhart on one side, and Osborne's office, and the Battlecruiser sets. And, you know, I mean, as a journalist, when I used to go, you know, to the set of Star Trek, I mean, you know, I was always blown away by, you know, those sets. And then to, you know, have it all be this stuff that we concocted from whole cloth, this original sci-fi universe, it was pretty great. And, you know, you enjoy those moments for the 10 seconds you can experience them, and then you put them aside and go back to work.
Right.
It was also like, sure, you know, designing all the characters' looks, you know, all the uniforms, everything is from scratch. There's no...
Yeah, that was challenging. That was a challenging time, because, you know, early on it was like, you know, what does the Terrians look like? What do Cronin look like? You know, what uniforms do they wear? I mean, and those were stuff that everyone needed answers. And, you know, the one thing Steve and I learned over time is you can't be indecisive, so you have to live with your answer. So you tell people, and, you know, you can give notes and everything, but... you know, but we didn't have the luxury of a lot of time. You know, a lot of big sci-fi shows, you know, they have a phalanx of conceptual designers, and, you know, they'll be doing, potentially developing for a year. I mean, when we got the green light in January, we were in the air in July. You know, we had to start shooting in April. So
you had to find everything. I remember you were like, when I was here, I only saw like places to be like, well, that cave system could be another world, that rock quarry could be another world, but I don't know where the university is. And then when you finally saw the university,
I mean, you know, people say, oh, you know, next season. You know, my biggest hope for the next season, you know, which we really all hope will happen, is just to have more time for prep, more time to write the scripts, more time to scout, more time to build stuff. That would be, you know, amazing, because I think, you know, at this point, you know, we're sort of midway through the season and we're already running on fumes, just because, you know, this pace is just, you know, crazy, and we have to stay one you know, step ahead of the production buzzsaw, which is always the case in television, but it's particularly challenging here.
And the post schedule is equally as insane.
It's brutal. I mean, we're delivering a week before air date, and, you know, we're getting into a point where the episodes are going to start airing. We're still in production, and that'll open up a whole new thing, which will be, you know, instant feedback. So it adds another whole wrinkle.
For better or for worse.
Yeah, for better or worse.
Interesting to see. And I think, you know, every cast member on the show, their life's going to change when the show airs on the 16th.
We keep telling them that, but I don't think they know what that means.
It hasn't hit them yet, but I think it's going to be a lot different for all of them.
It's going to change for this fly when I hit it in a second. Jesus. Oh, my God. So, yeah, we're in Sophia right now, and it's a gazillion degrees and humid, and there are all these flies.
I think they can hear the heat in our voice.
God. Yeah, I know, right?
Yes, I love this show.
Yeah, well, we just wrapped the previous episode, 107, and we're shooting 108 when we record this, and we're all very tired.
First day of 108. They're a little more tired than I am.
That's true.
I'm more acclimated here. I've been here for a long time now.
Yeah, so. Steve, Chris just got in 2 days
When 103 was filming is when I showed up, so I've been here since then.
Yeah,
so
that's when he was tired.
I was peachy yesterday, but I abused my energy because I stayed up late storyboarding because I was so excited by the script. I was like, I can't go to sleep.
I was giving notes, and he was storyboarding, and so... I think we were up way too late.
Yeah,
but, it's all good because we're excited about what we're doing.
Yeah,
we got a great cast and a great crew, and hopefully a great show. And I imagine you think so too, or you wouldn't be listening to this podcast. So anyway, that was Masters of War. Wonderful, wonderful episode. Very moving.
Hoo-yah!
Booyah.
Booyah.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, we'll look forward to having Chris back to talk about his episode of 109.
Yes, the aptly titled "It Ain't Me, Babe."
It ain't me, babe. You ain't the one I'm looking for, babe. Okay.
All right.
So join us on Unboxing Pandora every Tuesday, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is Mark A. Altman with Steve Crozier and Christian Gossett saying goodbye for now.
Blagodaria.
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 Blagodaria. Blagodaria.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.